Hines, Foye, Foye, Foye. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Mary J. Scholin presiding. All of our business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good morning. My name is Judge Scholin. To my right is Judge Greenberg. To my left is Judge Allen. We're here today to hear the case of Dudley A. King versus David J. Shulkin, M.D., Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 162959. Would counsel for each party please note your appearance for the record?
Good morning, Your Honor. Zachary Stoltz from Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick on behalf of Mr. King. With me at counsel table is Dana Weiner, also at Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ashley Varga on behalf of the Secretary, and with me is Christopher Wallace.
Thank you. Does counsel wish to reserve time for rebuttal?
Your Honor, if I could have 10 minutes, please.
Thank you. You may begin when ready.
Good morning, Judge Scholin, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Mr. King suffers frequent anger, frustration, dizziness, and loss of balance due to his service-connected hearing loss. These symptoms are not contemplated by the rating schedule because they are psychological and physical, not audiological. The Board agreed that Mr. King suffers occupational impairment from these conditions. As a result, the Board should have referred Mr. King's case for an extra-scheduler evaluation. Thun and Doucette instruct that where the schedule does not contemplate the level of symptom of disability and symptomatology, and the disability picture exhibits other related factors, like in this case, the significant occupational effects, the case must be referred to an authorized official to determine whether, to a court justice, an extra scheduler rating is warranted. This is because VA is required to account for a veteran's total disability picture. In an extra scheduler analysis, the Board should first identify the type and severity of symptoms the veteran has related to his service-connected disabilities and compare those symptoms to the assigned diagnostic code. This is done both with single disability and with combined disabilities when raised by the record. If there are symptoms not contemplated by the diagnostic code, the Board should address the effects of those symptoms and ask whether they present an unusual or exceptional disability picture pursuant to 38 CFR, section 3.321. Then, if there is an extra scheduler evaluation, VA should look to the entire schedule to see what rating for the symptoms or combination of symptoms would be commensurate with the average earning capacity.
If I may interject, counsel, do you accept the structure in Doucette that some things are hearing related and then some things are not, and potentially only the things that are not resultant from direct hearing loss are the things that are contemplated for extra scheduler evaluation?
I do.
Who is the person or body that is competent to determine whether something is related to hearing loss or is not?
I think that there are bodies competent to do this under the court's case law. It was discussed, for example, in the Kupamala decision. But the Director of Compensation has been assigned this duty in the first instance by the regulations. So the Director of Compensation is competent. Kupamala stands for the proposition that the Board is able to review the Director of Compensation's determinations, so the Board is competent. So the overarching fact finders at the Department of Veterans Affairs are competent and should and are required by law to conduct this analysis. Now the record has to be complete for rating purposes under the duty to assist. And so the Board or the director, or I suppose a decision review officer, frankly, would have to make a threshold determination that the competent medical and lay evidence is sufficient to conduct the required analysis under Thun and under Doucette.
Just more fundamentally on that question, does the Director of Compensation have any...
Does the Director of Compensation have any particular skills or qualifications for this job? Or is that director just an appointed official who must look elsewhere for guidance or assistance? And if so, why are we going through all this extra step? Why not just go through the ordinary processes of expertise being applied, send it up to the board?
To Your Honor's first question, I'm not aware that the Director of Compensation, this is a wide-ranging job. It wouldn't just be for hearing loss. This is a hearing loss case. I'm not aware of any special expertise that the director possesses. I am confident that the director has at his or her disposal resources within the Department of Veterans Affairs to answer these questions. I do know that it's the regulation 3.321 designates the Director of Compensation or the Undersecretary of Benefits to make this to conduct this analysis. But to Your Honor's second point, I believe, and forgive me if I'm getting it wrong, but to Your Honor's second point, the board was found in the Kupamala decision to be competent to conduct this analysis as well. It's the board's job to adjudicate disability compensation, and disability compensation encompasses 3.321. So, you know, at the end of the day, the board's going to make the call on the initial fact-finding, and then, of course, this court can review that as well.
So. Yeah, but that's my point. Why do we need a director of compensation level of bureaucracy? On the one hand, on the other, isn't this going to cause a lot of problems for the VA if every one of these cases gets extra scheduler consideration as a matter of right?
The court has funneled, to Your Honor's last question first, the court has funneled through the case law the number of cases that as a threshold determination have to go to the director. That is part of what was at issue in Doucette, that it has to be these symptoms have to be reasonably raised by the record or the veteran has to assert them on his or her own. So that narrows the class of cases. But my second response to that would be the regulations command that these go to the Director of Compensation for the initial determination after the threshold in FUN is met. I believe, Your Honor, that the board and I would cite Kupamala and Yancey as my support for this proposition. I would submit that the board can assign an extra scheduler evaluation in the first instance. The board can certainly oversee the Director of Compensation's decision. So it follows to reason that the board, in its capacity as the ultimate fact finder at VA, would be able to assign an evaluation.
Well, let me ask you this. What statute is involved? Forget these regulations. Or the cases, for that matter. What's the statute? Is it the broad statute requiring the secretary to give adequate compensation? What is it?
It's the broad statute. I don't think that I'm not recalling at the moment a particular statute that lays out the extra scheduler framework.
Right.
Everything that is cited with the many times that this court has struggled with this issue stems from 3.321, 4.21, 4.7, and 4.16b in the.
Would the struggle be easier if the court just stuck with the statute and directed the secretary to take care to comply with the statute? And identified, for example, the board as the proper device or enterprise to do this rather than keep engrafting these levels of activity.
That's a hard question. It's a hard policy question to answer. I assume that the Department of Veterans Affairs, which was in charge of drafting 3.321 and 4.16b, had a reason for designating the Director of Compensation and the Undersecretary of Benefits for the first go at assigning an extra scheduler evaluation.
Do you have anything other than your experience and skill for that assumption?
I do not.
There's no record made anywhere as to why these officials were selected. Or
if there is, I am not aware of it.
All right.
So on that point, it might be the case, might it not, that the reason for doing that at the time it was done may no longer have as strong a, quote, legal foundation as it did. In other words, I think this court rejected the notion in Kupamala that the assignment of the extra scheduler rating was a policy decision as opposed to something that would be reviewable by the board. So I suppose if one looked at this as a policy determination, then the initial assignment to those two officials might make more sense than if it were medical. Do you think that could have been a reason?
That reasoning makes a lot of sense.
So I want to ask you another question. I realize Mr. King's disability is hearing loss, and this is focused on hearing loss as one type of disability. But 3.321 is a general regulation. It does not make disability by disability determinations.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so are the arguments you're making applicable across the board, recognizing that how they apply in a muscular skeletal situation might be different than in a psychiatric situation or a hearing loss situation, but the fundamental principle of how this operates, are you comfortable with the fact that it is a trans-substantive type of rule?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. I'm comfortable with that because our position is based on the case law and based on, you know, as Judge Greenberg pointed out, the regulation, and as Your Honor pointed out, the regulation is broad and it's a little bit sparse. And so it took the court, frankly, in my reading of the law, several years, starting back in the 90s and then most recently with Thun and then Yancey and Johnson and Kupamala. And the proposal that we made in our pleadings, that Mr. King made in his pleadings, and the proposal that I am discussing today would have to apply all the way across. So it would have to be a test, at least as far as the way that I kind of can get through this, is it would have to be a test that VA would have to be able to understand and follow, both the Director of Compensation and the Secretary for Underbenefits, as long as that is what is required, and then eventually the board. No matter what happens, the fact-finding nature and adjudication nature of the board means that they would have to have this framework. And I would suggest that the framework is in place because of this court's decisions.
So here's how I look at this. And so tell me if I'm wrong. I've heard you before and you're not shy. So basically we have an ultimate goal under the Veterans Benefit Statutes, Title 38 or Chapter 11 at least, which is to make up for the impact on earning loss because of a disability. Okay, that's our goal.
Right.
A way to get there is through the established rating schedule.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. Sorry.
Is the do you understand that the extra scheduler rating is simply a different road to reach the same goal? In other words, we use the rating schedule to accomplish that goal. If it does it, give it the, because it's based on averages, right? So it might not always do it. But if it does it, we're all good. Perfect. If it doesn't, then the extra scheduler is saying, hey, that route's been blocked by the overturned truck. We're going to take a different road because we still need to get to the same destination. That's how I look at it. And tell me if you look at it differently.
The only difference that I see, Your Honor, is I don't see them as two different roads. I see them as different routes, but maybe not two completely different roads. They join back up, in other words, in a way. Because you do, I should say, the Department of VA, the first adjudicator, whoever is doing this extra schedule analysis first, and the entire analysis, has to run through the rating schedule. And hearing loss is a nice, easy example because it is, as Doucette points out, all it is a series of beeps and then you assign it a number. And so you do that. And so you're down this road of rating and you have completed that. But the road's not done yet. If the record or the veteran suggests or raises the possibility that there are other conditions related to the service-connected condition. They have to be related to the underlying condition. So you're still rating. You're rating hearing loss. He's also got, in Mr. King's case, the dizziness, the social interaction problems, and these things that are not hearing symptoms anymore. Because they're not hearing symptoms anymore and not contemplated by the diagnostic code, you stay on the road. And an extra, I'm trying to follow the metaphor. An extra scheduler evaluation kind of merges in. Because it's not a different analysis, it's an additional analysis,
well,
I suppose.
Why wouldn't it be a different analysis, though? In other words, you have a primary route, right? The primary route, the one that I'm going to drive on, is the highway. It's the best way to get there. It's the rating schedule. It's all established. And in theory, Congress could have simply, or the agency could have simply stopped mm-hmm. and said, you know what? It's on an average, and some people are going to get more than what they have. Some people get less because it's an average, and, you know, it'll all wash out at the end of the day. And they could have stopped, right?
Yes.
But it seems to me that 3.321 establishes this point that says, because these are averages, we know that an entire person isn't always going to be an average. And so if that doesn't get them to the goal, either because they have multiple service-connected obligations disabilities, or because there are things that just aren't contemplated by the rating schedule, one way or the other, if you haven't reached the goal, you know, back up and use a different route because we want to get to the goal. So maybe we're just quibbling about how it works.
But, yes, Your Honor, but getting to the goal, I think, I'm starting to understand Your Honor's question a little bit better. Getting to the goal, there has to be a way for the Department of Veterans Affairs, as I said, the initial adjudicator, there has to be a way for the adjudicator to have a trigger to know that they haven't reached that goal yet. Something has to be in the record, because otherwise it's just an amorphous goal of disability picture, and I recognize that. It's kind of like this philosophical, let's compensate everybody for what they deserve. But in order to make that fair, and in order to make that something that VA can do every time when it has 1.4 million claims in front of it or whatever that number is, in order to make it fair every time, there need to be signals along the way. There needs to be a way to know, oh, I didn't make my goal yet. We haven't made this veteran whole yet. Why haven't we made this veteran whole? Because FUN requires us to make sure that we follow 3.321. And so the way to do that is to look at those symptoms that are related to the underlying service-connected condition, but not contemplated in the diagnostic code.
So what if you had a situation in which the symptoms are contemplated by the diagnostic code, right? So in other words, the 30% rating says you have to have A and B, and the 50% rating says you have to have A, B, C, and D, okay? The person who's rated at 30 has A, B, and C, but not D. But D is contemplated by the rating schedule. It's just at a higher level, and he or she doesn't have the entire mix of symptoms, right? Because that's really what one of the questions in this case was about, is whether the availability of those higher ratings on the schedule level should then have an impact on extra scheduler. And what's your point about that?
My point is that because the extra scheduler analysis is a separate analysis, even if it's on the same ultimate road of getting to the goal of disability compensation, because it's a separate analysis, the board has to undertake that. The problem here is the board didn't even go there. The board didn't even start to undertake this analysis, so we truly can't understand, or I at least can't understand, why what the board really did, because they don't talk about the dizziness or the
or in this scenario, is it instead of A, B, and C, is it A, B, and F?
Right.
So it's not something that's halfway to D.
Because otherwise 4.7 would help. Right. Sorry, Your Honor.
Right, but my point that I'm trying to get at, and maybe that hypothetical wasn't the best one to do it, is I agree with you. I'm not entirely sure what the board meant when it said that the rating schedule contemplates higher evaluations than what he got. Is there any role for that type of at least general statement in saying, I will not refer for extra scheduler because the rating schedule itself contemplates higher levels of disability evaluations?
There would have to be, yes, it is contemplated. There would have to be another fragment on the end of that sentence, which would be, and I'm kind of spitballing here, but which would be, and the veteran's, the severity of that condition does not meet the next higher rating for X, 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 and X reason. I would submit that because something that was outside of the rating schedule, and I'm understanding your scenario to be something outside of the rating schedule was in the record or raised by the mm-hmm. veteran, the board would still have to conduct a THUN analysis. And if the ultimate conclusion is we did all this, but it's not exceptional or unusual, because the only thing he has is contemplated by the rating schedule, and the only reason we're not giving him the higher rating under the rating schedule is because it's not severe enough, or because we don't find him competent to testify to that, or whatever the reason is, as long as it's a good reason, then the analysis can stop,
so
and
you,
they don't have to refer.
You're conceding that the severity language in Thun is no longer material?
No, Your Honor. I'm just following that analogy through as to what the board could do to satisfy, to at least come close to satisfying its duty. But because Thun and Johnson both talk about severity, the board would still have to, and I'm sorry that I wasn't clear, but in that analogy, I'm assuming that the board is discussing the severity in its Thun analysis when it talks about the extra scheduler analysis.
So it says they qualify for the rating, and then it goes on to do an extra scheduler.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry that I wasn't clear about that.
I see you're almost out of time. I have some more questions. Don, if you could add 3 minutes to the schedule, to the time, please. I wanted to get back to where we started our conversation about who is competent and who can decide, or how do we decide whether something is flowing from the hearing loss versus a separate, not contemplated symptom. The Secretary, in his brief, argues that I think the social isolation is because of the hearing loss. Therefore, it's not an outside the schedule symptom. Could you please discuss that a little bit?
I disagree with the Secretary's characterization for the reason that social isolation, and just taking social isolation for this moment, social isolation is not an audiological symptom. The audiological symptoms, as this court pointed out in Doucette, are contemplated by 4.85 and 4.86. Dizziness, social isolation, the anger, those are non-audiological symptoms. So I can see that they stem from the underlying service-connected condition. That's why we're in an extra scheduler analysis. But they are not audiological symptoms. They are psychological and physical symptoms, which... Which Doucette's, in my reading of Doucette, that's the point of Doucette, is to say these are audiological, these are non-audiological. The extra scheduler analysis exists so that the board conducts an analysis of the non-audiological as well.
Now, in this case, the board did not discuss those symptoms and discuss whether they were audiological or not. So would the court have to remand for them to talk about them in the first instance, or could we do what they did in Doucette, was to say these kinds of things are not hearing related, board go back and figure out if they're hearing related? That was a little odd. But so what's the remedy you're seeking here?
The remedy is for this to go back with an instruction for the board to properly interpret the diagnostic code, which would be the first part of this, which is that these conditions are not contemplated by the hearing loss diagnostic code, and then for the board to discuss and apply the right law. So it's an interpretation of the diagnostic code and an application of 3.321 with this court's case law. So unfortunately, I do think that the remedy here is for it to go back to the Board of Veterans' Appeals, but with an instruction for proper interpretation and application of the law. It's not necessarily, although this is, in my opinion, of course, it is true that the board did not support itself with reasons or basis, but I think it's an even stronger remand than that. Because I think the board really will need some guidance from the court as to what it's got, what it has to do in order to properly follow the law here. But yes, Your Honor, I believe that this has to go back to the board.
And the Secretary also raised the question of whether his balance problems are related to hearing loss or not by pointing to some other criteria or disabilities.
Yes.
That would also need to go back.
It would have to, yes, Your Honor. The board, that was, we would argue that was pure post hoc rationalization.
Do you have anything further?
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court.
first to address the court's September 2017 order. The secretary.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to stop you, but if you could maybe pull the microphone closer to you. Thank you. We want to make sure we capture you for the audio recording.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Should I start over?
Please do.
Good morning, Your Honors, and to please may it please the court. First, to address the court's September 2017 order, the secretary does concede that the availability of higher ratings is irrelevant in any extra scheduler analysis. However, the board's use of such language here is harmless error because appellant's hearing loss symptoms are fully contemplated by the rating schedule.
So let me ask you just one point on that. I was going to get to this later, but so in the secretary's briefing, for example, in the page 4 and 5 of the supplemental brief, you say that the fact that the board mentioned the availability of higher scheduler ratings in a second part of a sentence was, I think the word you used was superfluous. But it's not entirely clear how you reach that point. So to take a silly example, if I said I didn't eat the pizza last night because I wasn't hungry and it had green peppers on it, how would you be able to tell just from that statement that the point about green peppers was superfluous? Because maybe I wouldn't have eaten it anyways because I don't like green peppers on pizza, right? And so how I'm just curious how the secretary can now say that what was one of two things the board said was superfluous, therefore leading to this harmless error point.
So, Your Honor, using your example from your sentence alone, I agree that it's unclear the reason why you personally chose not to eat the pizza. However, in this case, if you look at the board's analysis as a whole, the preceding sentence, the rest of the paragraph, it's clear that what the board did was actually look at the rating criteria and the symptoms as applied to that rating criteria, as opposed to merely the fact that higher ratings are available. And the board did discuss appellant's actual symptoms in the body of its decision. So when read as a whole, it's clear that what the board is doing is looking at the disability picture of the symptoms and applying it to the rating criteria to determine if those symptoms are contemplated, as opposed to whether simply an available, higher rating is available.
So how do we, I take that, but then how do we know, though, that that didn't infect its ultimate conclusion, right? Because let's just assume, and I know the secretary doesn't take this position, but let's just assume the board honestly thought the fact that there is a 50% rating means that you never get an extra scheduler rating if you're at 30, right? I know that's not what happened, but just stick with the hypothetical. If the board actually thought that, but also said the other things that you're talking about, comparing the things, how can we be at all sure that the fact that it was proceeding on a truly erroneous legal basis didn't infect its discussion? Because after all, it could be thinking, I don't have to give a lot of thought to this because I know this other point is correct, even though it turns out to be wrong.
Because in this case, Your Honor, appellant's symptoms are in fact fully contemplated by the rating that he has been assigned. First, the issue of the balance problems and the dizziness, the record is clear that those problems are not related to his hearing loss, and therefore they should not have even been subject to board discussion. The appellate concedes that some of his symptoms are not exceptional to hearing loss, so I'm gonna focus on the evidence that appears to be an issue with your discussion with the appellant, the balance problems and dizziness, and potentially the anger that he feels. So, to address Judge Sholin's question about the balance problems and dizziness, the May 2011 VA examiner was explicit that those problems are related to appellant's non-service-connected perforated eardrum condition, and service connection for that condition was denied in a May 2012 rating decision. So VA has decided that the balance problem dizziness are not related to service, and that decision became final. So those conditions were not subject to the board's discussion in its extra scheduler analysis.
But what if the appellant had raised them in his testimony or some other filing to the board? Wouldn't the board have had an obligation to discuss them and make that determination that you're asserting now?
No, Your Honor, because those conditions have already been determined to be.
Right, but if the appellant argued that these things were service-connected or that they were, I'm sorry, extra-scheduler symptoms that the board should have considered, the board doesn't get to just ignore it because it's right. It has to explain that, right? And I believe that the appellant had asserted those symptoms before the board or below. So you're making a post hoc rationalization now, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm not aware of a situation. I'm not aware of where in the record appellant asserted that before the board other than the May 2011 examination.
Okay, so your position is that's the only time it was raised. I'll get into that with your colleague on rebuttal, and we can check the record later. But
yes, sir. Let's
assume that you're correct. Then please proceed.
Yes, that is our position, that was the only time it was raised. And again, it was denied service connection in the May 2012 rating decision. The other evidence that appears to be at issue is appellant's anger that he can't hear his wife. Appellant is already service-connected for PTSD, which includes his anger control problems. He is receiving a 50% rating for that condition, and under the court's decision in Yancey, because that symptom is contemplated by the PTSD rating, it is also not subject for an extra-scheduler analysis. So for those reasons, the board's decision here, even considering that language regarding the availability of higher ratings, is harmless error because appellant is already being compensated for his symptoms. His hearing loss symptoms are fully contemplated.
So, but on that point, for example, couldn't it be the case that somebody could be have a situation where, let's just take, you are service-connected for PTSD and you're service-connected for hearing loss, and PTSD at the rating level that you're at, you are getting something for anger. But couldn't it be the possibility that somebody who has hearing loss could actually make the symptoms of the PTSD more severe than the rating schedule contemplated because of the interaction? So let's just take this, hypervigilance for PTSD. You could imagine a situation where if a person can't hear, they're actually going to be hyper-hypervigilant. In other words, they're going to be more on guard because they no longer can hear the things that they're afraid of coming to get them. Couldn't that work in a situation like that? And the board didn't really talk about any of that here.
Sure, Your Honor. Let me address your question in two parts. So first, in this case, there's no evidence that appellant's anger because he can't hear his wife somehow exacerbates his PTSD anger problems. That the only testimony that we have here is a bald statement by appellant's wife that he gets very angry because he can't hear her. There's no indication that that reaction to his inability to hear is unusual or exceptional or otherwise not contemplated by his disability ratings. To answer your more broad hypothetical question, when rating disabilities, and especially mental health disabilities, we look at the overall symptomatology. The rating criteria, it's not as if we're looking at anger caused by hearing loss versus anger caused by PTSD. When evaluating those conditions, we're looking at simply anger. And what does the overall level of anger amount to when providing a disability rating? And again, in this case, appellant has been noted to have anger control problems, impaired impulse control problems, possibly leading to unprovoked periods of violence. He is receiving a 50% rating for that condition. And under the court's decision in Yancey, where symptomatology is contemplated by an appellant's or a claimant's disability ratings, that symptom is not subject to an extra scheduler analysis.
Well, but doesn't that leave out the point of severity? In other words, your way of looking at this, which might be correct, is that this is sort of like a light switch. It's either on or off, right? There's either anger issues or there aren't, right? Where one could look at it like a dimmer switch. In other words, there's different severities of anger, right? There's a difference between anger and, you know, Hulk-like anger. And so doesn't the way you've sort of characterized this leave off the idea from the case law that suggests we also look at the severity of symptomatology, not just the existence?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because, again, the rating criteria in this specific case for mental health disorders looks at the overall disability picture and how it affects occupational impairment. It doesn't look at the individual symptoms. You're looking at the total level of occupational impairment. So severity is a factor for this appellant's PTSD because it will get him to a higher or lower rating.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about a statement in your brief that talked about that the appellant needed to show that the symptom would cause industrial impairment in order to get an extra scheduler or higher rating. Can you talk about what you think the appellant would need to demonstrate and where you're getting that requirement from?
Yes, Your Honor. First, the requirement comes from the language of 3.321 itself that looks to the occupational impairment that is caused by an appellant's disability. And the reason for that is the rating schedule is intended to compensate for the average impairment that a disability is caused. And we assume that certain disabilities will come with certain levels of social or occupational impairment, and that sort of provides our baseline. We assume that you experience certain things because of a certain disability, and we will compensate you accordingly. For extra scheduler analysis, again, the rating schedule is intended to compensate for the impaired earning capacity. So in order to demonstrate that your disability goes above and beyond that which is contemplated by the rating schedule, you need to show that your impaired earning capacity, the impairment in your earning capacity goes above and beyond what is in the rating, what is contemplated.
That would be a step two analysis under Thun? Or are you requiring this additional demonstration of decreased earning capacity or industrial impairment as part of step one in figuring out whether the symptom is contemplated by the rating schedule?
No, Your Honor. To clarify, that would be part of the step two analysis.
And before you finish that, because it's related to this, right? So you do agree then that at step one, Thun, we look at the rating schedule, and then we look at the and what's contemplated by that, and then we look at the symptomatology and severity of the individual claimant to decide whether that presents the exceptional disability picture. If it doesn't, we can be done. If it does, we move to step two, in which we say, are these the impact, the industrial impact, the marked effects on employment, et cetera, right? And so I just want to make sure that you agree with what I think you just said to Judge Shulman, that whether or not it has an effect on employability matters not at all at step one of Thun at all, right?
Yes, Your Honor. That is precisely the analysis that the court provided in Thun and that the Secretary agrees with.
Picking up on the discussion I had with your opposing counsel about who can make the determination of whether this symptom is hearing-related or flows from the hearing loss. In your brief, you argued that the social isolation stemmed from the decreased hearing itself and therefore was not the kind of symptom contemplated by Doucette to be a non-hearing-related symptom. Who makes that call? Is that a medical question? Is that a factual question?
I'm going to answer the question in two parts.
Okay.
First, just to clarify, there is no evidence in this case that appellant experiences social isolation due to his hearing loss. What the evidence states is that he gets angry that he can't hear his wife. I think that the evidence was classified that way during briefing, but the actual evidence of record does not seem to indicate that appellant experiences social isolation because of his hearing loss.
Well, but doesn't that, though,
go to the
discussion. That goes to the question, right? Because if, in fact, that is a medical, let's say, judgment, then what the parties say in their briefing is really irrelevant to this, right? The board would have to make that determination. But if it's not, if what we say, there are facts A, B, and C, can the court, for example, say those facts A, B, and C can be characterized as social isolation, right? And I think that's the fundamental question that Judge Sherwood is getting at. Is it a factual determination, a legal determination, a medical factual determination?
Yes, Your Honor. It would simply depend on the facts of each case. It would be a case-by-case analysis whether there is sufficient evidence of record by lay statements or statements made by a claimant to his physician, statements by a physician. It would just simply depend on what's actually in the evidence of record. And here, again, there's simply the bald statement by appellant's wife that he gets angry that he can't hear her. And as to the social isolation question, the testimony in that that appellant provided was that he just needs to have his wife face him in order to hear her and has to have others face him so that he can understand what they're saying. So he is able to communicate with others if he makes some accommodations. So it's not clear that his inability to hear prevents him from interacting with other people.
Is the Secretary staying with its assertion, in this case at least, that both in the main brief and in Secretary's supplemental brief, that portion of Doucette concerning these functional effects not contemplated, and then the list of examples, is dicta?
Your Honor, the Secretary does stay with the position that those specific examples of non-hearing related symptoms are dicta. However, again, in this case, that distinction and really whether that portion of Doucette is dicta or not is irrelevant because the balance...
I get that. Here's the point I'm getting at. It's so although the Secretary is a single thing, a single person, Secretary Shulkin exists in the world, right? For many purposes, Secretary Shulkin is a they because there are lots of cases you get. I don't have to tell you that. I'm not aware of other briefs before this court in which the Secretary has taken the position that there's a portion of Doucette that is dicta, which is a polite way of saying not binding on the agency. And so I want to be clear. You're here speaking for the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Is it the position of the Secretary of Veterans Affairs that there is a portion of Doucette that is dicta and therefore not binding on him?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so then in every other case where people have submitted briefs to the court, they're just not making that argument. I want that very clear. You're doing a great job. I need to have that point very clear.
Yes, that is exactly it, Your Honor.
Now, if in this case the court were to decide that his anger was not something that is hearing related, that would be central to the case and not dicta, though, right? Chris is
yes.
nodding.
yes,
okay. If this court were to say the board did not make a factual determination as to these three symptoms, X, Y, Z, and sent them back because the board needed to address these and determine whether they were hearing related or not hearing related, that would not be dicta. But I'm not clear what the rule would be that would be taken away from there.
I'm not sure if this answers your... I'm trying to answer your question the best I can, but in that case, if the court determines that the anger is not related to hearing loss, that was...
No, if in the second scenario, if the court just says, the board didn't talk about these things, we're not going to make a factual determination in the first instance, we're going to send it back to the board, they need to talk about these things. They need to decide whether they're covered, contemplated by the hearing loss diagnostic code or not. Would that address your Doucette problem, or would the agency still have the same position?
Okay. I think I understand your question now, Your Honor. In that case, as the court stated in Doucette, if the hearing, if all that's being alleged are hearing symptoms that are fully contemplated by the rating schedule, then the board does not even need to get into a discussion, does not even need to decide that they are.
Well, in order for us to do that, we would need to make a decision that they're not hearing related. And can we make that decision in the first instance?
Whether...
Because the board didn't talk about them.
Whether a symptom is related to the service-connected condition, whether it's contemplated by the rating schedule, is a factual determination that needs to be made by the board in the first instance.
Okay. You can conclude.
For those reasons, Your Honor, because appellant's hearing loss symptoms are fully contemplated by the rating schedule, the board's decision should be affirmed.
Thank you. Mr. Stoltz, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do want to start my rebuttal by reiterating that the severity of symptoms is something that should be taken into consideration. And when I, Judge Sullivan and Judge Allen, the availability of a higher rating, it does seem that the Secretary has conceded as well, does not stop the analysis of whether there should be an actual schedule or evaluation. In this case, the Secretary is asking this court to make fact-finding in the first instance. And the Secretary's reading of the evidence is not exactly our reading of the evidence. For example, the bald accusation or the bald statement from the Secretary or from the veteran's wife is not a bald statement. At 666 in a medical examination, it says effective occupation, significant effects. This is a hearing loss case. This is a hearing loss exam, unless I'm missing something. Poor social interactions and hearing difficulty. So I'm not sure that the poor social interactions, and this is all fact-finding, and I probably shouldn't even be getting into it, but just for the record, the social interactions are not just a bald statement at the hearing. The dizziness is discussed in a hearing loss examination in the record. It stems and it is specifically found that these symptoms are related to the veteran's service-connected hearing loss. Again, I'm getting into facts. I know that Judge Sholin indicated that she may want to hear from me a little bit about that on rebuttal. So just to dust up our reading of the evidence, on behalf of Mr. King, these are not bald statements. They are supported elsewhere in the record.
So though on the factual point, okay, and probably this goes back to Judge Sholin's fundamental question. Okay. So clearly Doucette said there are things contemplated by the rating schedule and there are functional effects that are not. So you're with me on that.
I am with you, Your Honor.
And then the court gave a list, non-exhaustive, but a list of things. Okay? And I know that we have another case coming a month or so from now called Morgan that's going to probably talk about that more. Those things that were on that list, do you agree that determining what's on that list of those functional effects that aren't contemplated by the rating schedule, do you agree with what the Secretary said at the end, which is those are actual factual questions, right? That may be a bad question. Let me ask it this way, okay? We said social isolation in Doucette, right? That was one of our list. Were we just saying that may be something that the board could determine, subject to the clearly erroneous standard of review, is on the list, Or were we saying, we have determined that social isolation as a matter of law is a functional effect that can not be contemplated by the rating schedule, and the board's factual job is to determine on the facts of a given case, does that equal social isolation? Do you follow what I'm saying?
I do, and it's the latter.
Okay.
It's a legal pronouncement in Doucette. That's why it's in there. That's why it's not dicta. That part of Doucette, in my reading of Doucette, is to get us home. It's to get to the holding of the case. Otherwise, it's just a reiteration of Thun. Doucette, to get to the holding that non-audiological symptoms should be considered in an extra scheduler analysis, it was necessary for the court to articulate that. So it's a legal pronouncement. It's up to the board to start filling in the blanks on the factual findings.
So this is very important to me about the standard of reviews on an appellate court, critically important. So if there then were to be something else that we're going to add to this potential list of functional effects not contemplated, okay, let's say marital discord, okay, is the determination of whether marital discord as a, quote, symptom is not contemplated by the rating schedule, is that a question of law or a question of fact?
It's a tough one.
Well, you're thinking, right? That's distinct from the question of whether or not there was marital discord here, right? That's a factual question. But is the content of the list of things that are functional effects not contemplated by the schedule, is filling in that list a question of law or a question of fact?
It is a question of law, Your Honor. And my support for that is because functional effects is a legal term used in the ratings, used in 3.321, and it was a legal term used in Thun, used in Johnson, used in Cupamala, used in Yancey. That's a legal concept. And so what impairs a veteran socially or physically are legal questions. Now, whether the individual's symptoms arise to that is a factual question in the first instance. But, Your Honor, your question, my answer to that is it's a legal question. And putting aside any discussion that I started on the facts, the fact remains the board did not do any of this analysis. And because there are symptoms in this case that are not contemplated by the pure tone threshold loss that is articulated in the diagnostic code, an extra scheduler analysis must be conducted in accordance with the law. And we ask this court to set aside the board's decision and remand with instructions to properly interpret and apply the law.
Thank you. The case will be submitted for decision. The court is now adjourned. We'll come down and greet counsel.